How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. Crossover episode today. So I'm Fred Katz from Locked On Thunder, and I'm here with Jared Dubin of Locked On Knicks before the Thunder play the Knicks on Wednesday night. Jared, what's going on?
Not too much, man. How are you?
Good. I'm tired. I just got back from D.C. Travel kills me. Like, I was thinking, like, I could use an all-star break, and I was really thinking that. And then I realized that I'm spending 4 straight days in New Orleans for all-star for a hectic weekend, plus it's Mardi Gras. And I was like, well, I'm not going to get much rest.
So two things about that. First of all, never complain about spending 4 days in New Orleans again.
No, New Orleans is awesome. That's like one of my favorite cities of all time. I'm obsessed with New Orleans.
For me, like, New York is home. Like, Miami was where I went to school, so it's like my second home. And like some of my family's still down there, so I still love that. But New Orleans is, you know, my favorite city that I've never lived in. It's incredible. I have a friend from college who, you know, his house is on St. Charles Ave, where all the parades come down during Mardi Gras. We spent like a week there, senior year of college during Mardi Gras. It was unbelievable. Like, one of the best experiences ever. I went down there again when I was in law school to work for the public defender's office when it wasn't Mardi Gras, and that was honestly even better. Like, basically, I just worked for the public defender from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. for 4 days, and all the other time I had to, you know, myself with me and my friends from law school, and it was amazing. Like, I love that city so much, and I'm jealous extremely that I won't be an all-star this year, because it's going to be incredible in New Orleans. And then the second thing is, you know, you mentioned you're looking forward to that break. Like, I've gone to, I think, like 4 or 5 games over the last week and a half or so. Every single person I talk to is just like, I'm so ready for this break. I'm so tired. This is the worst time of year. It's like I've had more conversations about that than anything else.
Yeah, I'm exhausted. January killed me. Like, the Thunder had the worst January schedule. They had 12 out of 15 on the road. So I was just, like, so exhausted. I got, like, a solid week and a half at home, but I'm tired. And, like, as you very well know, maybe the listener doesn't, like, we don't get days off at all. Like, we don't get weekends, we don't get Saturdays, we don't get Sundays, we don't get Wednesdays. Like, we don't get days off during the season. So I'm taking 3 days off after All-Star. I'm taking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday after All-Star, and I am pumped for that. It's going to be awesome.
Well, that's, you know, the 3 days leading into the trade deadline, although I don't imagine the Thunder will be too active, so you may not have as much to do. You know, for me, it's covering the whole league, but from one place. You know, those are busy days, but at least I'm not running all over the place.
Yes, that is definitely true. You want to talk some Knicks Thunder?
Yeah, let's do it. Why not?
So last time we saw a Knicks Thunder game, Thunder won that game. That was in New York, and it looked like at the time that it was like, hey, this is a pretty decent win for the Thunder. The Knicks aren't great, but they're good enough, and it's on the road, and, you know, it's a decent win. And the Knicks, after starting whatever they were, 16-13 or whatever it was, they've lost, what, like 20-27 or something like that?
They were 8-8 at the time of that Oklahoma City game. I just looked at that. It was a fun game too. Westbrook was obviously ridiculous. 17 rebounds, 14 assists, whatever it was, like 28, 29 points. Good game, fun game down the stretch at the Garden for sure. The Knicks, you know, they were 8-8 before that game, and they're now 23-33. So they are, you know, 15-25 since. And I mean, they were 16-13 heading into their Christmas Day game, and they're 7-20 since then. So it's been, it's not been great, although the most recent game might have been their best win of the year, beat the Spurs with pretty much everybody. I mean, Powell is still hurt, but everybody else played, and the Knicks just came out and beat them at home on Sunday, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, and, like, that was a game where, like, Kawhi played a really good game. Like, Kawhi had, what, 35 or 36 in that game?
Yeah, he had 36. He played really well. The problem was nobody else played well.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Parker put up a donut.
Yeah, Parker and Mills were pretty bad.
Danny Green just had an off shooting night like crazy.
Yeah, Danny Green and Aldridge, I think, combined to go something like 7 for 30 or something like
7
that.
Seven for 29.
Yeah, it was bad. 7 for 29 with 21 points combined. Now that I look at it, again, you know, Kawhi was the only guy that played well. The Knicks, I mean, Carmelo played pretty well, especially down the stretch. Courtney Lee had a nice all-around game. Rose got to the basket. Hernan Gomez, again, was, you know, kid's been awesome lately. It's been really fun.
You know, the one thing you have to give props for the Knicks for, I forget who made this point. It might have been Chris Herring made this point, that they have good international scouting.
Yes, they do.
They've made some good picks.
Like, just fringe roster guys as well. Like, they've done a really good job with that. I mean, granted, Chris Copeland and Pablo Prigioni both were fringe roster guys that came from, you know, internationally. But, I mean, they also found Jeremy Lin, Steve Novak, a couple other guys. They've done a really good job with the back half of their roster. It's the big moves that have given them trouble over the last few years.
Right, right. And, I mean, even if you look at just this current roster right now, I mean, obviously Porzingis was 4, but everyone knew, you know, people were at least high enough on Porzingis that he was a guaranteed, you know, top 6 pick or something like that. Maybe he wasn't going to go 4, but he was like obviously guaranteed lottery.
Came out before the draft and said that he might be the best player in the draft.
Right, granted, exactly.
He was the only person that thought that at the time, but, like, it was not so out there to think that he would be a top 5-6 pick in the draft, which he was.
Right, but, like, you know, you get Hernan Gomez was, you know, second round pick, and he's a legitimately useful NBA player. I kind of like Kuzminskis.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame that he's 27 because if he had the skill set he has now and he was 22, 23 with some room to grow, he could grow into, you know, eventually as you taught him defense, could grow into like a really nice bench player. I think, you know, at his age, he's probably just going to be what he is, which is, you know, a situationally useful bench player, depending on, you know, the forwards the other team has in the game. Where you know there's certain guys he just can't survive against defensively, but if you can get him out there, he's useful for sure. He's got a nice shot. He gets to the basket against closeouts. You know that's another good find that they got from overseas. I mean even some. I mean Mo Endor doesn't really play, but he has a somewhat similar skill set, and he's an international guy too.
And even, you know, you talk about just the fringe of that, like Lance Thomas, another one of those guys too. Oklahoma City fans know him. Like he and the Thunder are an organization that's usually really good at identifying that sort of talent and also like honing that sort of talent, developing that sort of talent. And you know, he was one that got away in that deal. I don't think the Thunder nearly thought he was gonna be like the type of player that he's kind of become, and he's also a guy who's kind of a useful guy.
I remember talking to Scott Brooks about Lance Thomas when he was with OKC, and the thing that always jumped out at me when he was at Duke, then when he was with OKC, and I think he was with another team maybe before that too, was that, and it's been the same thing with the Knicks, although this year he hasn't shot well. He just knows where to be all the time, and he gets there at the time that he's supposed to be there, and that. For a bench player that is sort of like a fill-in-the-blanks kind of guy, is a really useful skill and a really underrated skill. And that was something that Brooks talked about as well. So that's something that I think has stayed with him in New York, and especially last year, you know, which was clearly his best season. This year he's been dealing with injuries, so he hasn't played as well. But he still has that thing where offensively and defensively, he knows where to be and what to do when he gets there. And that's a good skill to have.
All right, I'm going to ask you the question again that I so rudely interrupted you with before. What is up with the Knicks defense? And so I watch a decent amount of Knicks just because, like, for those who don't listen to the podcast regularly, I am, and for, I guess, the Locked On Knicks listeners, I'm I am from New York and grew up in New York and lived in New York, and all of my friends from growing up are huge Knicks fans. So I watch a decent amount of Knicks just so I can, like, keep up in our text threads. And they all just watch the Knicks religiously. And, you know, like, the amount of times the name Oakley has been texted to me over the last week.
We'll get to that, I'm sure.
I'm sure we'll discuss that. It's unbelievable. But one thing that I want to know is, look, the Knicks don't have a ton of great defensive players, obviously. You know, Rose is not a defensive point guard, and you know, everyone knows Melo's reputation, and Noah's not what he used to be. And the guy that I want to know is Kristaps Porzingis. Mm. I kind of thought he was going to be a better defensive player this year than he's been in terms of being a help defender and a rim protector. And I'm wondering if you're, I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, I recall last year you being pretty high on his defense in terms of just what it's going to end up being into the future. And I'm wondering if you have a different take now on his future as a defensive player.
So there's a couple things, obviously, to say about the Knicks defense. First of all, it's bad. That's the understatement of the century. It's really bad. It's been hovering in or around the bottom five most of the year. Right now they're tied for 25th in the league with the Kings, I believe, which is, you know, that tells you basically all you need to know about the actual quality of their defense. Why is it bad? You know, largely because they have a bunch of bad defenders. But, you know, specifically, you know, to me, from, you know, watching them, not every game, but most games, and from knowing that the skill sets and tendencies of the guys on the team, most of it starts at the point of attack. Rose and Jennings both have, you know, a very maddening tendency to die on screens. And when the point guard dies on the screen, the opposing ball handler can get into the paint, can get to any spot on the floor he wants. And then the Knicks have a very aggressive help system. And if that help comes from the perimeter, it leads to an open three. If that help comes from a big, it leads to a look right under the basket. And that has been happening to them pretty much all year from everybody uniformly. It's been happening to Carmelo. It's been happening to Courtney Lee, Holiday, Kristaps, Noah, O'Quinn. Everybody has been, you know, infected by the overhelping that all starts with breakdowns at the point of attack. You know, somewhat to their credit, they knew, I think, that they were going to have bad point of attack defense once they got Rose. And I think that that is a large part of the reason they thought Noah was going to be a good fit for them. He's played better lately in the games that he's played. He's been out for the last few with an injury. You know, before that, he had been playing a little bit better. But for most of the season, he had been straight up bad defensively and not moving really very well at all, not looking like the Joakim Noah that we've seen. You know, even over the last 2 years when he struggled offensively, he was still really good on defense. He did not look like that for a lot of this season, and then had started to before he got hurt late a few games ago, but now he's hurt again. With Kristaps in particular, what you mentioned, he's actually been really good protecting the rim. His rim protection numbers are right up there with the best guys in the league. Like, if you look at it, Rudy Gobert is averaging...
Right, he's at like 42% with guys at the rim, right?
Right. Gobert is at 43.1. Porzingis is at 44.4. So when he actually challenges shots at the rim, dudes are not making the shots. His issue has been that, you know, because he's playing almost exclusively at the four, you know, he's played the five some, but not quite as much necessarily as you might like. That's forced him to defend more often on the perimeter than you would want to see. And I think that's really the area where his defense has regressed. Early in the season, his interior defense wasn't quite as good as it was last year, but I think that's rebounded. His perimeter defense and his help defense in terms of being able to go from a shooter on the perimeter to tag the roll man and then get back out under control to contest a three and not let his guy drive by him, that has been his big issue on defense this year. And I think a guy that's that size and that build is just never going to be able to do that really well consistently. And that's, you know, a big part of the reason that he needs to move to center in the long term.
Right. No, I mean, look, I think one of the most legitimate criticisms of the Knicks offseason is just that Porzingis has got to be playing the five. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got to be playing the five. They've got to be developing him as a five.
Even if he's not, like, there are two other centers on the team that are better than Noah. So,
well, that too.
Hernan Gomez and O'Quinn have both, I think, been better than Noah this year. And for the most part, the Knicks have played better without Noah. So,
I feel bad asking this question because I don't like
yes, he's the worst player in the league.
Yeah.
It's not particularly close right now. I mean, we knew that the moment that...
Worst contract in the league. Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's the worst contract in the league.
As soon as our friend Tim Bontemps reported it the night before, I think we were talking at the time, and we were like, oh my God, that's the worst contract in the league.
Mm-hmm. This is not a case of hindsight being 2020 and them signing the deal, and now, you know, it hasn't worked out, so it's a bad deal. Like, that was a bad deal when it happened. I texted with people in the league when that deal happened, and like two people I spoke to gave me, this is not verbatim because I don't remember my texts from 7 months ago, but it was something along the lines of like, what in the world is that deal?
Yeah. And I think we might have been talking at the time too, because we were talking about like the Wizards were supposedly going after him too, and we were like, why would they do that?
Yeah, well, the Wizards signed a lot of centers.
Yeah,
but hard to knock the Wizards right now with the way they're playing.
No, it worked out for them not getting Joakim Noah.
Yeah, well, they're playing great.
Yeah, they were here a few weeks ago, and I was talking to them about, you know, they started off the season so badly, and I was talking to them about, you know, they were on a minor hot streak at the time, and I was like asking them, like, why do they think that this is more reflective of the real quality of the team? And they gave me a bunch of different answers, and all of those basically have turned out to be true over the last couple of weeks since then. So
yeah, well, they just did. You watch any of that game, that Thunder Wizards game on Monday night?
I did. I can't believe what they missed, 22, 23 straight shots.
24 shots in a row.
Unbelievable.
I've never seen anything like that. I don't think.
Which streak gets broken first, that streak or the winning streak that Miami had a few years ago?
Oh, 27.
No, it wasn't. Miami wasn't the longest streak of all time, though, right? There was like a 33.
The Lakers won 33, and I forget what year, 74, 73?
Yeah. I feel like that might get broken before a team misses 24 shots in a row again.
Is 24 definitively a record? I didn't actually look it up.
I don't know if it is, but I feel like either way, someone will win 34 games in a row before a team misses 25 shots in a row, given how good shooting is these days.
Yeah, although maybe it's more likely for a team to miss a bunch of shots in a row because people are more concentrated on threes, which are technically a lower percentage in terms of the chance of you making it, but a higher efficiency.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. But it's also I would imagine there's also a higher concentration of like layups and floaters, because it seems like it's the mid-range game that's been eased out, not the close shot game.
Right. True. So, what a depressing conversation this is.
Yeah. So let's speaking of guys missing shots, Oladipo started off the year, I think in the first four games he shot like 8% from the floor. But then there was a point like maybe 15, 20 games ago where he was shooting in the high 30s from three.
Yeah.
Now he's down to 35%. I think since like January 1st, he's at like 26, 27% from three. What's been going on with him?
He's honestly, I mean, he had the wrist injury, which is still bothering him. You still see him occasionally shaking out the wrist. He had a wrist sprain. He missed 9 games. That was December 9th, December 11th, something like that. He suffered it, and then he missed 9 games. And he came back a few weeks later. And it's still there. It still lingers. And he'll mention it to you. If you probe him about it, like he'll eventually say, like, yeah, it's bothering me, but like, what am I supposed to do? So I don't know how much of it is the wrist injury. I don't know how much of it is just like he's come, because it's not like he was a 38% three-point shooter in his career. He was around 35.
A knockdown catch-and-shoot guy throughout his career.
And his catch-and-shoot numbers were great. Yeah. Here's what it is. You've looked at the splits month by month. Have you looked at the shooting chart, though, the shot chart?
Because
I wrote something on his shooting slump like 2 or 3 games ago. And he's great from the corner still. Like, even amidst this slump, he's doing well from the corners. He's, I haven't checked after the Washington game, but I think he still leads the league in percentage from the right corner among qualifying players. Like he's shooting like 50% or close to it from the right corner. And he's shooting, and he's shooting like comfortably above league average from the left. He's like, he's still in the low 40s from the left corner, but he's in the high 20s from above the break. Not making anything from above the break. And to me, and during this stretch where he's slumping like crazy, he's about league average from the corners. And he's like 20% from above the break. To me, maybe that means it's something with the wrist because those above the break shots are, you know, a little bit farther. You need a little bit more, you know, oomph behind it with your, and if you have a wrist injury, makes total sense why that would happen. Something that I did with Domantas Sabonis, who's also in like an unbelievable shooting slump right now and is shooting like 15 or 16 or 17% over the last month and a half or so from three. And something that I did was because, you know, people are theorizing, you know, he's tired, he hasn't played this many games, rookie wall, all that stuff. And he seemed like he was missing short a lot. And so his three-point percentage peaked at halftime against Boston on December 23rd. He was shooting 44% from three at that point. He's down to 32% right now. And I went through and watched all of his threes and just charted where the misses were. And before that Boston game, 40% of his misses were just short. And, you know, the rest were either long or wide right or wide left. And since the halftime of that Boston game, over 60% of his misses have been short. That's something that maybe I'll do with Oladipo. Because I think if he's missing short way more often, then maybe we can more definitively say it's something with the wrist, because I think that would be consistent.
You might be able to say it if he's missing wide more often too, because it could just be like, you know, depending which side of his wrist hurts.
True.
If he's compensating by, you know, with one side of his hand or his wrist or the other, that could cause it to go wide a little bit too.
That is true. That is true. That is very true.
Why can't Anthony Morrow make a shot? Is it just that, like, he only gets on the game for a couple minutes at a time and he doesn't get in any rhythm?
Yeah, you know, he talks about being a rhythm guy and being a rhythm shooter, and I think that's something that that is definitely part of it. You know, it's something that I actually have been meaning to ask him recently. I just haven't had a good time. I'm going to ask him, like, hey, why are you shooting 29% from three? He's never shot worse than, I don't think, 37% from three. You know,
and he's one of the best shooters in the world. Like it's very strange for him to not be hitting shots, even if he rarely plays.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is a weird thing. You know, he's reworked his shooting form, and like, I'm sure you've noticed that like he does that thing where he doesn't bring the ball down when he catches it on catch and shoots. And
yeah,
it's
something that I think he had to do because there wasn't going to be as much space without KD.
Mm-hmm. He loves it. Apparently, he started doing it because he's from Charlotte, and Del Curry used to do that.
Right.
And he grew up a huge Hornets fan, and Del Curry is one of his favorite players ever. And he always he said he always just tried to mimic Del Curry. So he and Stephen Curry actually, grew up together and practiced in the same gyms and stuff. And he said that he and Steph used to practice that together. And they used to do that together when they were in Golden State together too. And they would just practice that. And he decided he wanted to incorporate that into games because he just thought, well, I'm going to make my release a lot quicker. I wonder if that messed with his shot, because like he shot a very good percentage last year, but he shot below his career percentage. I think he was 37%, which is very good, but it's below his career percentage where he's like a 40 some odd percent, 3-point shooter. I wonder if that messed with his shot to a degree, because, you know, 29% is just uncharacteristic.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, look, it's a bad shooting team in general. They're at, I think, 32% from three as a team, which obviously is not very good at all.
Yeah, they're just like a hair better than Chicago for worst in the NBA.
So, I mean, another interesting thing to me, obviously Cantor is out with the broken whatever from being an idiot. I mean, how do you think they're faring without him coming off the bench so far? And how does the way that they're adjusting for it compare with what you expected when he first went down?
They've done a pretty poor job, I'd say. They've had a couple of times where the bench has played okay, but for the most part, They're getting pretty killed when Westbrook is off the floor. And I pretty much expected that. I mean, one of the narratives of this season is that the Thunder can't play well when Russell Westbrook isn't on the floor. But for the 5 or 6 weeks leading up to Cantor's injury, that wasn't quite true.
Did he break it in again? It was against Cleveland, right?
It was against Dallas.
So the night before Cleveland. So they are 3-6 since then.
Yeah, and the Westbrook on-off numbers are pretty jarring in that time, too. They've really struggled in third quarters since then, too. I don't know if that has anything to do with Cantor because they're getting killed with starters on in third quarters, too. But if you look at those numbers, those Westbrook on-offs, 5-6 weeks leading up to it, when they started running their offense like disproportionately through Cantor. He was touching the ball every single possession, and he – like the thing that he worked on the most this summer is passing out of double teams. He got really serious about passing out of double teams. And the one thing about Enes Kanter, that dude is like the most open, honest interview in the entire league. Like I was asking him what did you need to improve on? He was like, I used to be so scared. Like he just flat out said, like I was so scared whenever they would come over and double team me. I hated it. I hated getting double teamed. I was getting double teamed all the time. And I would just try to score because it was the only thing that I knew how to do that I was somewhat confident in. And I would just try to score whenever I get double teamed or triple teamed. And it was bad for me and it was bad for my team. And I wasn't a good player because of it. And he just flatly says that kind of stuff. And he said that he worked on his double, on passing out of doubles. And he goes through reads. It's a little formulaic now, but he's good at it. Like he's not the best passing big man in the league or anything like that, but he's an above average passing big man, and certainly good enough to where, and he's such a good post scorer that he's certainly good enough to where two guys come over and every single team double teams him. I can't think of one team in the league that doesn't do it.
So it's also like, it makes a lot of sense for them to run that second unit offense through him because first of all, as you mentioned, he's a really good post scorer and a lot of the second unit offense earlier in the season had been running through Oladipo, but with the wrist injury, that's not quite as tenable. So it made sense that they made a big shift toward Cantor. And obviously the injury there is killer. There's nobody to run the offense through if Oladipo can't do the things that you want him to do. And if Cantor's not out there as an outlet valve.
Right. And it's not just Oladipo. I mean, Cameron Payne has been, he's been a subpar offensive, I mean, two-way point guard right now. He's not shooting well. He's not facilitating particularly well. They've tried playing Steven Adams for big minutes with the second unit in time, in moments of late. Gotten away from that a couple of the last few games. But because, Adams was getting up there, he's playing high 30s minutes and getting into the 40s some games. And that's just not a sustainable model for an entire season or for a long term or more than just a few games. But Payne is a guy who, if he plays well, the second unit's going to look a lot better if he makes shots. But he hasn't really done that. He's 34-35% from the field.
Is it that big of a surprise that he's not playing well, given that he's coming back from, a stress fracture in his foot?
I thought he'd be a little better than this. I don't think it's, unacceptable that he's not. And I'm not necessarily, shocked or anything by it. But it's not so much that he's not making shots to me as it is that he's playing really out of rhythm. Like he looks like a rookie still, which I guess is not shocking considering that he was hurt some last year. And even when he was playing, he was still in a walking boot between games and he wasn't getting consistent minutes or anything like that. And so it's not necessarily shocking.
Playing time was basically cut to nothing.
Yes, true. But at the same time, the part that is kind of disappointing to me is not, I think he's going to start to make shots at some point. I don't know when it'll be, but he's not getting the worst looks of all time. It's not like he's doing a horrible job creating looks for himself or he's taking these terrible shots and everything's contested and he can't get space or anything like that. It's not quite the case. He's missing shots. The part that's a little discouraging for me is that when he comes in, the offense kind of loses its rhythm. He'll get the ball at the top of the key. And this is the example that I use a lot. He'll get the ball at the top of the key and he'll, and this is not just on him. It's also on, a screener and the rest of the offense. But he'll stand there for 11 seconds before they initiate some sort of action. And you don't see that necessarily happening as much when Oladipo is the guy running it, although it absolutely does happen at times too. And it's something
that he does what a lot of what I like to call Tony Douglasing the screen. He basically just dribbles from one side of the screen to the other and doesn't put any pressure on the defense, you know, whether it's going toward the basket or dribbling into a shot. That's like the worst thing that a ball handler can do when he comes around a screen. Obviously it's named for former Florida State guard, Tony Douglas.
Is that how Tony Douglas is going to be identified? Former Florida State guard?
Yeah, well, he's
implying
on...
implying he never even made it to the NBA?
He's on Memphis now. I actually saw him last night when I was at the Nets-Grizzlies game. I didn't talk to him because I don't talk to anyone that went to Florida State. But, he's a nice guy, but he was not a very good point guard, is what I meant there. Look, we're talking about a bunch of Thunder guys that are struggling. So let's geek out for a few minutes over Andre Robertson, because if this guy doesn't make first team all defense, I think we might have to quit having the first team all defense.
He's really good. Casual fans in Oklahoma City hate him. It's frustrating. He's such a good defensive player.
Yeah, I mean, look, when a guy is, you know, you're starting small forward, he averages like 6 points a night. He shoots like 8% from the field. He has like a 9 PER. It's easy to think that he's not a good player because the things that most fans associate with being good, he doesn't really do a lot of. But when you're out there locking horns with the best guy every night and you do it like he does with the arms and the feet, like you have to have, obviously, like the most important thing on defense is your head and your feet. And he's got that down so much. But if you can add the arms into it too, like with the arms and the hands, like him and Kawhi and Jimmy Butler and very few other guys in the league are able to have all three of those things working at the same time all night, every night. It's a rare level of defense that he's in right there.
Yeah. And something that's going to help him make an all defense team too, is the fact that he starts at small forward, but he mostly guards. Mm-hmm. So you can legitimately justify putting him on an all defense team as a guard or a forward. So it kind of opens up 8 spots to him on first or second team as opposed to just 4, which is going to make things a lot easier for him as opposed to, you know, like Kawhi is making it anyway, but Kawhi can only make it as a forward.
Right. And 2 of the spots on the first team are taken up already with Kawhi and Draymond.
Exactly. So you can justify putting like him and, you know, Tony Allen at guard or something.
Do you have to take a center in all defense?
Yes.
Because if so, then all of the front court spots are locked up with those 2 and Gobert.
Exactly.
So if he wants to be on the first team, he's got
it. I'm not convinced that Gobert is going to be first team.
Oh, he's going to be first team.
Look, I would vote for him for first team, and I can't quite think of who I would.
DeAndre Jordan might get the first team votes.
DeAndre Jordan might get – that's exactly what I was going to say. DeAndre – it's all about – it is – okay, so I was having this conversation with Andre Robertson. Like it's all about it's all about reputation.
Yep.
All defense. Like I would not be shocked if Andre Robertson did not make all defense.
Kobe Bryant made the all defense team like 8 times after he stopped playing defense officially.
Yeah. And it took like Tony Allen too long to make it.
Yeah.
Like now we think of Tony Allen as this like staple. It's like the Supreme Court. Once you're on it, you're just on it. You're just there. Or it's like being a referee.
Well, it's funny because I think Tim Duncan made more first team all defenses than anybody in history and never won Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, that's a weird thing that he never won Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah, I mean, he was the best defensive player in the league for 19 years and never won it.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. But it's like, you know, once you're on it, you're on it. You're good. You're good to go. Like it's all about reputation. And it's about steals and it's about blocks. Now I think people are a lot better now than they were 5 years ago.
It's also like there's no good way to measure defense. So a lot of it is, again, like you said, reputation. And a lot of the voters are guys that don't watch every team every night. So a lot of it is based on, you know, what guys tell them or who they watch most or guys that are on the team they cover. You play in Oklahoma City, you're not necessarily –
the most watched guy.
Right. No, it is true. And that is why, so great transition. This is my final question, then we'll wrap up. Not Thunder related, but it is a question that I want to get your opinion on. Who's better, Kristaps Porzingis or Nikola Jokic?
I mean, look, right, the way they're playing right now, Jokic is playing significantly better than him, especially since Kristaps came back from his injury, which was, you know, maybe like a couple weeks after Jokic started starting again. And Jokic is unbelievable right now. I mean, he's destroying the league every night. Kristaps has been, for the most part, struggling since he came back from his injury. You know, the question becomes different, I think, when you talk about ceiling. You know, Jokic, I think, has a more well-rounded offensive skill set because of his ability to pass and playmake from the high post. Kristaps just has such a higher ceiling as a two-way force because he has the potential to be, you know, an all-defense type of defender if he can harness everything that he has into, you know, what it could possibly be. Jokic, I don't think, will ever be a good defender. Like, I think he can get to average, but just the way he moves and the way he is largely groundbound on that end means that he's going to top out near average. Kristaps is already better than that, and if he gets to elite, that will be enough, I think, to make up for the difference in well-roundedness of skill on the offensive end. And Kristaps obviously has the potential to be an elite offensive player too, based on his ability to shoot, you know, the ability he showed early in the season of being able to create his own shot. And then, you know, if he ever gets like one or two moves in the post that are incredibly difficult to stop, then all of a sudden he just becomes impossible on both sides. So, you know, Jokic is certainly playing better right now, especially lately. I think he's probably had the better season. But in terms of who has the potential to be a better player, I think because of the defense, I would still lean toward Kristaps. Even if maybe Jokic might be more likely to fulfill his full potential, I think there's a space where even if Kristaps doesn't fulfill his full potential, that he can still be an overall better player than Jokic if he becomes the kind of defender that I think he can be.
I agree. But tonight, if I need to win a game, go on Jokic, man. That guy is the most ridiculous passer. He's like a top five. He's a top five passing big man right now.
It's like if Marc Gasol started shooting threes his second season in the league.
He's still like 21, 22 years old.
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous.
He's all-star good. He doesn't deserve to make the All-Star team because he hasn't played enough minutes because he wasn't playing enough minutes early in the year because it took Denver like weirdly long to realize that he was better than Nurkic. But I mean, you know, I shouldn't be snarky about that. I'm an advocate for as long as the team makes the right decision, there's not really a reason for them to knock him for taking a little bit longer because they got different information than we do. But he's going to be an All-Star next year. Like he's so fun to watch. Good.
Like I was talking about it during the Knicks Nuggets game the other day, and Jokic came out and slapped up you know another ridiculous line, and I said on Twitter like Jokic is just insanely good. Like it's just a complete offensive skill set, and somebody I can't remember who it was. Somebody tweeted back at me like, yeah, everybody does this against the Knicks, and I was like, you really need to watch more Jokic because the dude is absurd.
So much of this is geography. And that's the reason why I made the transition from like talking about like Robertson and people not, you know, him being in OKC and how that might hurt his all defense case. Like if Porzingis were in Denver and Jokic were in New York, Jokic would be the massive star.
I think it also has something to do with Porzingis broke out immediately upon coming into the NBA. Like if Jokic.
Right. But okay, think about how big Linsanity was. Jokic, since the new year, is averaging like, what, 23, 11, and 6 or something like that?
Yeah, he's insane.
Like, if a 21-year-old center were 23, 11, and 6 for a month and a half with the Knicks, my goodness, can you imagine the coverage that would be getting?
Oh, yeah.
He'd be a star already. He'd be a star, and he's not quality wise. He is, but from a fame perspective, he's not. And he doesn't have the personality
to the insular community of those of us that cover and follow the NBA closely. He absolutely is, and I feel like so many people talk about how nobody's talking about Jokic that it's become like, okay, people are talking about him now. But if I went up to, you know, one of my friends and was like, you know, yo, how good is Nikola Jokic? They'd be like, who is that?
Right. Nope. It is very true. He'll be known one day, real soon, I think.
I would certainly hope so, because that would mean that more people are watching him do what he does, which is absurd.
All right, what do you got to plug before we go?
You know, just read my stuff, follow my stuff, listen to the podcast. You can find the podcast on Twitter at LockedOnKnicks. Reach out, LockedOnKnicks@gmail.com. And I'm on Twitter at JADubin5. And I send out all my work and all the podcasts there.
Yep, and you can subscribe to Locked On Thunder on iTunes. You can find me on Twitter at Fred Katz, FredKatz, or email me, LockedOnThunder@gmail.com. Log on to NormanTranscript.com. Check out Thunder Road. That's my blog there. You can see all my Thunder coverage. We're going to be back tomorrow with a wrap-up of the game, right?
Yep, let's do it.
So we'll be back tomorrow with a wrap-up of the game. Until next time, Locked On Thunder and Locked On Knicks. We're locking up.